The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 2, On the Man Called Christ. Chapter 1, The God in the Cave. This sketch of the human story began in a cave, the cave which popular science associates with the caveman, and in which practical discovery has really found archaic drawings of animals. The second half of human history, which was like a new creation of the world, also begins in a cave. There is even a shadow of such a fancy in the fact that animals were again present, for it was a cave used as a stable by the mountaineers of the uplands about Bethlehem, who still drive their cattle into such holes and caverns at night. It was here that a homeless couple had crept underground with the cattle, when the doors of the crowded caravanserai had been shut in their faces. And it was here, beneath the very feet of the passers-by, in a cellar under the very floor of the world, that Jesus Christ was born. But in that second creation there was indeed something symbolical in the roots of the primeval rock, or the horns of the prehistoric herd. God also was a caveman, and had also traced strange shapes of creatures, curiously colored, upon the wall of the world. But the pictures that he made had come to life. A mass of legend and literature, which increases and will never end, has repeated and rung the changes on that simple paradox, that the hands that had made the sun and stars were too small to reach the huge heads of the cattle. Upon this paradox, we might almost say upon this jest, all the literature of our faith is founded. It is at least like a jest in this, that it is something which the scientific critic cannot see. He laboriously explains the difficulty which we have always defiantly and almost derisively exaggerated, and mildly condemns as improbable something that we have almost madly exalted as incredible, as something that would be much too good to be true, except that it is true. When that contrast between the cosmic creation and the little local infancy has been repeated, reiterated, underlined, emphasized, exalted in, sung, shouted, roared, not to say howled, in 100,000 hymns, carols, rhymes, rituals, pictures, poems, and popular sermons, it may be suggested that we hardly need a higher critic to draw our attention to something a little odd about it. Especially one of the sort that seems to take a long time to see a joke, even his own joke. But about this contrast and combination of ideas, one thing may be said here, because it is relevant to the whole thesis of this book. The sort of modern critic of whom I speak is generally much impressed with the importance of education in life, and the importance of psychology in education. That sort of man is never tired of telling us that first impressions fix character by the law of causation, and he will become quite nervous if a child's visual sense is poisoned by the wrong colors on a gollywog, or his nervous system prematurely shaken by a cacophonous rattle. Yet he will think us very narrow-minded if we say that this is exactly why there really is a difference between being brought up as a Christian and being brought up as a Jew or a Muslim or an atheist. The difference is that every Catholic child has learned from pictures, and even every Protestant child from stories, this incredible combination of contrasted ideas as one of the very first impressions on his mind. It is not merely a theological difference. It is a psychological difference which can outlast any theologies. It really is, as that sort of scientist loves to say about anything, incurable. Any agnostic or atheist whose childhood has known a real Christmas has ever afterwards, whether he likes it or not, an association in his mind between two ideas that most of mankind must regard as remote from each other. The idea of a baby and the idea of unknown strength that sustains the stars. His instincts and imagination can still connect them when his reason can no longer see the need of the connection. For him, there will always be some savor of religion about the mere picture of a mother and a baby, some hint of mercy and softening about the mere mention of the dreadful name of God. But the two ideas are not naturally or necessarily combined. They would not be necessarily combined for an ancient Greek or a Chinaman, even for Aristotle or Confucius. It is no more inevitable to connect God with an infant than to connect gravitation with a kitten. It has been created in our minds by Christmas because we are Christians, because we are psychological Christians, even when we are not theological ones. In other words, this combination of ideas has emphatically, in the much disputed phrase, altered human nature. There is really a difference between the man who knows it and the man who does not. It may not be a difference of moral worth, for the Moslem or the Jew might be worthier according to his lights, but it is a plain fact about the crossing of two particular lights, the conjunction of two stars in our particular horoscope. Omnipotence and impotence, or divinity and infancy, do definitely make a sort of epigram which a million repetitions cannot turn into a platitude. It is not unreasonable to call it unique. Bethlehem is emphatically a place where extremes meet. Here begins, it is needless to say, another mighty influence for the humanization of Christendom. If the world wanted what is called a non-controversial aspect of Christianity, it would probably select Christmas. Yet it is obviously bound up with what is supposed to be a controversial aspect. I could never at any stage of my opinions imagine why. The respect paid to the Blessed Virgin. When I was a boy, a more Puritan generation objected to a statue upon my parish church representing the Virgin and Child. After much controversy, they compromised by taking away the Child. One would think that this was even more corrupted with Mariolatry, unless the mother was counted less dangerous when deprived of a sort of weapon. But the practical difficulty is also a parable. You cannot chip away the statue of a mother from all round that of a newborn child. You cannot suspend the newborn child in midair. Indeed, you cannot really have a statue of a newborn child at all. Similarly, you cannot suspend the idea of a newborn child in the void, or think of him without thinking of his mother. You cannot visit the child without visiting the mother. You cannot, in common human life, approach the child except through the mother. If we are to think of Christ in this aspect at all, the other idea follows as it is followed in history. We must either leave Christ out of Christmas or Christmas out of Christ, or we must admit, if only as we admit it in an old picture, that those holy heads are too near together for the halos not to mingle and cross. It might be suggested, in a somewhat violent image, that nothing had happened in that fold or crack in the great gray hills, except that the whole universe had been turned inside out. I mean, that all the eyes of wonder and worship which had been turned outward to the largest thing were now turned inward to the smallest. The very image will suggest all that multitudinous marvel of converging eyes that makes so much of the colored Catholic imagery, like a peacock's tail. But it is true, in a sense, that God, who had been only a circumference, was seen as a center, and a center is infinitely small. It is true that the spiritual spiral henceforward works inwards instead of outwards, and in that sense is centripetal and not centrifugal. The faith becomes, in more ways than one, a religion of little things, but its traditions in art and literature and popular fable have quite sufficiently attested, as has been said, this particular paradox of the divine being in the cradle. Perhaps they have not so clearly emphasized the significance of the divine being in the cave. Curiously enough, indeed, tradition has not very clearly emphasized the cave. It is a familiar fact that the Bethlehem scene has been represented in every possible setting of time and country, of landscape and architecture, and it is a wholly happy and admirable fact that men have conceived it as quite different, according to their different individual traditions and tastes. But while all have realized that it was a stable, not so many have realized that it was a cave. Some critics have even been so silly as to suppose that there was some contradiction between the stable and the cave, in which case they cannot know much about caves or stables in Palestine. As they see differences that are not there, it is needless to add that they do not see differences that are there. When a well-known critic says, for instance, that Christ, being born in a rocky cavern, is like Mithras having sprung alive out of a rock, it sounds like a parody upon comparative religion. There is such a thing as the point of a story, even if it is a story in the sense of a lie, and the notion of a hero appearing like Pallas from the brain of Zeus, mature and without a mother, is obviously the very opposite of the idea of a god being born like an ordinary baby and entirely dependent upon a mother. Whichever ideal we might prefer, we should surely see that they are contrary ideals. It is as stupid to connect them because they both contain a substance called stone as to identify the punishment of the deluge with the baptism in the Jordan, because they both contain a substance called water. Whether as a myth or a mystery, Christ was obviously conceived as born in a hole in the rocks, primarily because it marked the position of one outcast and homeless. Nevertheless, it is true, as I have said, that the cave has not been so commonly or so clearly used as a symbol as the other realities that surrounded the first Christmas. And the reason for this also refers to the very nature of that new world. It was, in a sense, the difficulty of a new dimension. Christ was not only born on the level of the world, but even lower than the world. The first act of the divine drama was enacted, not only on no stage set up above the sightseer, but on a darkened curtain stage, sunken out of sight. And that is an idea very difficult to express in most modes of artistic expression. It is the idea of simultaneous happenings on different levels of life. Something like it might have been attempted in the more archaic and decorative medieval art. But the more the artists learned of realism and perspective, the less they could depict at once the angels in the heavens and the shepherds on the hills, and the glory in the darkness that was underneath the hills. Perhaps it could have been best conveyed by the characteristic expedient of some of the medieval guilds, when they wheeled about the streets a theater with three stages, one above the other, with heaven above the earth and hell under the earth. But in the riddle of Bethlehem, it was heaven that was under the earth. There is in that alone the touch of a revolution, as of the world turned upside down. It would be vain to attempt to say anything adequate or anything new about the change which this conception of a deity, born like an outcast or even an outlaw, had upon the whole conception of law and its duties to the poor and outcast. It is profoundly true to say that after that moment there could be no slaves. There could be and were people bearing that legal title, until the church was strong enough to weed them out. But there could be no more of the pagan repose in the mere advantage to the state of keeping it a servile state. Individuals became important in a sense in which no instruments can be important. A man could not be a means to an end, at any rate, to any other man's end. All this popular and fraternal element in the story has been rightly attached by tradition to the episode of the shepherds, the hinds who found themselves talking face to face with the princes of heaven. But there is another aspect of the popular element as represented by the shepherds, which has not perhaps been so fully developed, and which is more directly relevant here. Men of the people, like the shepherds, men of the popular tradition, had everywhere been the makers of the mythologies. It was they who had felt most directly, with least check or chill from philosophy or the corrupt cults of civilization, the need we have already considered, the images that were adventures of the imagination, the mythology that was a sort of search, the tempting and tantalizing hints of something half-human in nature, the dumb significance of seasons and special places. They had best understood that the soul of a landscape is a story, and the soul of a story is a personality. But rationalism had already begun to rot away these really irrational, though imaginative, treasures of the peasant. Even as systematic slavery had eaten the peasant out of house and home, upon all such peasantries everywhere there was descending a dusk and a twilight of disappointment in the hour when these few men discovered what they sought. Everywhere else Arcadia was fading from the forest, Pan was dead, and the shepherds were scattered like sheep. And though no man knew it, the hour was near which was to end and to fulfill all things. And though no man heard it, there was one far-off cry in an unknown tongue upon the heaving wilderness of the mountains. The shepherds had found their shepherd. And the thing they found was of a kind with the things they sought. The populace had been wrong in many things, but they had not been wrong in believing that holy things could have a habitation, and that divinity need not disdain the limits of time and space. And the barbarian who conceived the crudest fancy about the sun being stolen and hidden in a box, or the wildest myth about the god being rescued and his enemy deceived with a stone, was nearer to the secret of the cave, and knew more about the crisis of the world than all those in the circle of cities round the Mediterranean, who had become content with cold abstractions or cosmopolitan generalizations, than all those who were spinning thinner and thinner threads of thought out of the transcendentalism of Plato or the orientalism of Pythagoras. The place that the shepherds found was not an academy or an abstract republic. It was not a place of myths allegorized or dissected or explained away. It was a place of dreams come true. Since that hour, no mythologies have been made in the world. Mythology is a search. We all know that the popular presentation of this popular story in so many miracle plays and carols has given to the shepherds the costumes, the language, and the landscape of the separate English and European countrysides. We all know that one shepherd will talk in a Somerset dialect, or another talk of driving his sheep from Conway towards Clyde. Most of us know by this time how true is that error, how wise, how artistic, how intensely Christian and Catholic is that anachronism. But some who have seen it in these scenes of medieval rusticity have perhaps not seen it in another sort of poetry, which it is sometimes the fashion to call artificial rather than artistic. I fear that many modern critics will see only a faded classicism in the fact that men like Crashaw and Herrick conceived the shepherds of Bethlehem under the form of the shepherds of Virgil. Yet they were profoundly right, and in turning their Bethlehem play into a Latin eclogue, they took up one of the most important links in human history. Virgil, as we have already seen, does stand for all that saner heathenism that had overthrown the insane heathenism of human sacrifice. But the very fact that even the Virgilian virtues and the sane heathenism were in incurable decay is the whole problem to which the revelation to the shepherds is the solution. If the world had ever had the chance to grow weary of being demoniac, it might have been healed merely by becoming sane. But if it had grown weary even of being sane, what was to happen except what did happen? Nor is it false to conceive the Arcadian shepherd of the eclogues as rejoicing in what did happen. One of the eclogues has even been claimed as a prophecy of what did happen. But it is quite as much in the tone and incidental diction of the great poet that we feel the potential sympathy with the great event. And even in their own human phrases, the voices of the Virgilian shepherds might more than once have broken upon more than the tenderness of Italy. Incipe parve puer, risu cognoscere matrem. They might have found in that strange place all that was best in the last traditions of the Latins, and something better than a wooden idol standing up forever for the pillar of the human family, a household god. But they and all the other mythologists would be justified in rejoicings that the event had fulfilled not merely the mysticism, but the materialism of mythology. Mythology had many sins, but it had not been wrong in being as carnal as the Incarnation. But something of the ancient voice that was supposed to have rung through the graves, it could cry again. We have seen, he hath seen us, a visible God. So the ancient shepherds might have danced, and their feet have been beautiful upon the mountains, rejoicing over the philosophers. But the philosophers had also heard. End of Part 1 of Book 2, Chapter 1.